Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Melody Lauer.
Oh, hello.
You started yawning as I'm...
No, I was in the middle of a yawn as you said that. And I was like, gotta finish this up.
I mean, didn't you know I was going to say your name and ask you to say something?
I don't think you can choose those things. I think it's an involuntary thing.
Don't yawn! No, you can. It's fine.
I'm sorry. I have not had any coffee and I'm hungry. My tummy just grumbled.
Hey, guess what?
What's that?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition and LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, you can really never have too much ammo. So, joining us, Carl Wren. Carl, how's it going, man?
It's great.
Good, good. I'm glad to have you back on the show. It's been a while, and I think the last time you were on, you were talking about red dots, which is still upsetting the internet to this day. But I thought it was good stuff. And you got a new thing we're going to talk about that I actually think is really cool, and I'm really looking forward to coming out and experiencing myself. But before we get there, say who you are, what you do, and we'll get going.
All right. My name's Carl Wren. I'm based out of Central Texas near Austin. Spent about 33 years as a researcher and as a trainer in the government world with DOD and DHS and a couple of major universities down here in Central Texas. Retired from the state, and now I am full-time doing KR training, which I've been doing. I've been doing that business since 1991, but now I'm doing a lot more of it. And that's a local firearms training school. I got my own permanent range and starting to do some traveling now in this next year coming up to do some more presentations of this particular course that we're going to talk about.
Cool. So I first heard about this, I want to say a month or maybe a month and a half ago, I think, is when you publicly announced. And I apologize if I'm getting my time frame wrong. I don't actually keep very good track of the days anymore. But it's historical handgun. And what is that? And what's the class do? And we'll hop right into why I think it's really, really interesting, even if you're not a history nerd.
The whole idea was to go through the modern era of handgun skills, which I start kind of with the double action revolver in the 1930s and through the present day, and really just map out the evolution of the standards that they trained to and the drills that they ran and the techniques that they used to give everyone a better appreciation of the whole history of handgunning, and also to understand, I think there's a common perception amongst particularly younger people that before YouTube and the internet, there was no firearms training, and that the people, the names they recognize from YouTube and Instagram and all that, that those people invented a lot of techniques. And in reality, most of this stuff has been around for a long time, and the variations that are, you know, happening now, they're good. They reflect 80 years of knowledge, but they're not unique or magical or special. And a lot of this stuff has been known for a long time. So I think it's good. Anybody that's serious about studying a handgun should know where we came from and really probably be proficient with more than one gun type. And part of the course, the advanced part of the course is actually using double action revolver and 1911, double action, single action pistol and a striker fired gun to finish the class.
Well, and it seems like too, that it, I, we can't go a month or two before a guy my age or maybe even younger will come up with something new, and then I look at it and I go, well, one, that technique is not new. Two, it was abandoned for very specific reasons. And three, the only reason it existed in the first place was due to the limitations of the equipment of the day, and it doesn't make any sense in, like, a new environment. Have you noticed that or seen a lot of that in the past?
Yeah, I mean, recently I ran into groups of people who didn't know the foundational names, you know, from the 70s moving forward, people who don't know who Jeff Cooper was or what he did, or, you know, Naz Ayoub, what he did, or going back even farther, somebody like Ed McGivern or Applegate, Fairbairn, those guys. I mean, understanding who those people were and why they're important, I think it's like not knowing who Chuck Berry was with regards to music, or not knowing who Beethoven was.
Right.
You know, it's like those people matter, and they did make an influence, and what we have now wouldn't exist without them. And so it's good to know, even if you're not their biggest fan, you need to know who they are and what they did.
Right. So I guess let's start just at the beginning of the class. And you say you start out with double action revolvers in the 1930s. What are some of the differences, I guess, between, how people train today versus how they did back then, or just some of the, what do you think is interesting about that particular period? And then we'll sort of just work through the entire, timeline there.
Well, back then, there was very distinct. There was one-handed bullseye shooting, mm-hmm. which was done at 25 and 50 yards at a glacial pace timed with a calendar or perhaps a sundial. And then there was hip shooting, where there wasn't time to aim and there wasn't time to bring the gun up to eye level. And so all the firing was done with the gun held down at waist level or mid-chest level. And over and over again in the books and the videos and the you know, instructional films from the 30s and 40s and even in the 50s, they just repeat this over and over again. There's not time to aim. There's not time to aim. And then if you watch the videos, many of them aren't shooting very well at mm-hmm. the distances that are realistic. And so, you know, there was a long period from the 30s to the 70s where drawing from a holster wasn't that important, and getting good hits up close was not done very well, but at the same time, those people could shoot better in their era at 25 and 50 yards than it appears modern day shooters can, because they practiced it all the time.
Why do you think there was such a focus on longer range accuracy when I would assume even the engagements back then occurred at closer distances?
I think some of it came from the military.
Mm-hmm.
That, for example, we shoot the U.S. Army handgun qualification test from 1940, and they use the same target for that they're using for the rifle qualification. And so I think they moved in thinking, well, we're not ever going to be that close, and so they need to be able to hit at 25 and 50 yards so that the enemy doesn't get to 10 yards.
Right.
And so some of it was they just took the rifle curriculum and scratched out rifle and wrote in pistol. And a lot of the one-handed shooting, I think, came from the fact that their hands were occupied with reins, right? Mm-hmm. There's cavalry training in some of the old Army manuals. It's how to shoot while riding a horse.
Right.
And so, of course, you only had one hand on your pistol. And so a lot of it, I think, it was just incrementally people started to figure things out as they went along. But a lot of it just came from the rifle side, that the pistol, if you look at the old books, rifle shooting was what it was all about. And pistol was always sort of a third class, you know, citizen. It was, oh, yeah, we have these pistols and let's just go shoot some rifle courses of fire with these pistols.
So it's funny, too. So is that just an assumption that one context will transfer over perfectly to another context? I guess
probably it's. There's a few people, the law enforcement side, and you really see the difference, for example, the 1945 FBI course of fire versus the 1940 military course of fire.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI course of fire includes prone, sitting, kneeling, running from position to position, firing rapidly at 7 yards, doing reloads under time pressure. It's way more complex and difficult and physically demanding than the Army qual was. And so the law enforcement side, much more tuned into, gee, this is our gunfights are going to be much more, I hate to use the word dynamic, but that's really what it was. Their gunfights involved a lot more duration, and they involved a lot more different things and different skills, whereas the military, it's like, we just need to qualify these guys with a pistol because they're gonna have it with them, and they need to know how to load it, and you know, they need to be able to hit stuff at longer distances, so hopefully they won't have to do anything more.
Right. So we got to go to break. So right now we're talking with Carl Wren, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories, Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977, a legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match grade accuracy, superior ergonomics, and concealability with modern service pistol capacity and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we're talking with Carl Wren about your historical handgun course, and we were discussing some of the differences between the 1945 FBI qual versus the 1940 Army qual. Why do you think, or when do you think, the change occurred to where, at least on the federal LE side, they're like, hey, this looks different than what we had been doing in the past? Was there like a watershed incident, or was it just something that sort of developed because of who was in charge?
Is that a good question? The article I got the 1945 call from was written by J. Edgar Hoover for the NRA magazine, which is sort of fascinating. Huh. You wouldn't, in the modern era, you wouldn't see the FBI director writing anything for the NRA magazine. So the fact that that even happened in that era is certainly a cultural indicator of how things were. Basically, the FBI agents were involved in a lot more gunfights. There was a lot more shootings. The FBI and the G-men and all the revenueers, all that stuff, they had just come out of Prohibition era and the gangster era and all that sort of thing. And so they had people that had a lot different experience than the soldiers, right? Because there was a gap between World War I and World War II. And think about the Army qual was probably, we've got millions of people we have to get through the handgun qualification and get them over to the battlefront. And so it's going to be a lot easier to get somebody to pass a slow fire qual that everybody stands together in one line and there's no barricades and there's no reloads and all that. So some of it was necessity. The qualification has to be simple so we can run, 80 people through it at a time and get them done and move on to the next thing. And the law enforcement guys, they it was more important to them. The handgun was far more important to them because they knew the likelihood they were going to use it was much higher, I think.
Well, and I guess that's sort of like necessity is an amazing motivator at times. So as far as, I guess, what's the next phase of the class? So after we do like double action revolvers from the 1930s period on up, where
then it's the 1911 era.
Okay.
It's the gunsight era. It's the Jeff Cooper era. It's the leather slap era. And so, for example, in the early part of the class, they can shoot one-handed. They thumb cock the revolvers. Some of the shooting is done two-handed from the revolver. But really, everything moving forward from the 70s, you get into the Weaver era, and then we shoot Weaver. We shoot a 1911. We shoot Weaver. We're going to shoot, tests from the gunsight era, which are a lot more closer distances, but emphasis on getting the gun out of a holster quickly. It's the first time you really see a draw time matter. Mm-hmm. When you've got a two-shot drill, the draw time becomes super important. When it's a 20-round drill and you draw once, the draw time's not as critical. But when it's a 10-round shooting test and it's five draws, all of a sudden the draw time becomes the majority of the thing that's tested. That's a huge shift.
What do you think brought that on, or what were you able to find, or what history is there as far as the thinking that went into emphasizing draw times more?
I think it came from study and actual incidents.
Mm-hmm.
There's more and more, many, all the changes that ripple forward from the 70s to the current era, it all comes from better after-action analysis of what actually happens. That's why going forward you see the time frames for the shooting speed up, you see faster, closer range drills, you see more emphasis on draw time, and that's because they try harder and harder as they move forward to make the drills reflect what was actually going on.
Yeah.
And so certainly draw time, you know, understand, prior to the gunsight era, the only draw time that mattered was cowboy fast draw with six guns and, you know, blanks and balloons and stuff. And so they learned how to time the draw stroke with the fast draw craze, and then that sort of technology crept forward into, well, how about we actually use two hands and aim the pistol and try to hit stuff? Gee, we can use the same equipment we're using to play fast draw. We can measure real draw.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because I know, and this is sort of tangential, but I know there was, like, on a very small scale, some of that in the 1940s with some of the training that the OSS was doing with their pistols and inoperatives. But that was very kind of narrow and didn't make it into the public eye until, like you said, the gunsight era. As far as like more of an emphasis on the draw times mattering and getting the gun up and using the sights, were there any other like radical shifts in thinking that went from one to the other as well? Or was there anything different about the equipment that made life less frustrating?
Better sights.
Yeah.
That's a huge issue, the quality of the sights. And a lot of the sight evolution, it looks like it happened in the 50s and 60s, mostly driven by police pistol competition, the PPC.
Yeah.
And better manufacturing, too. But you started seeing more and more target sights or more and more high-visibility fixed sights. Brass beads and other things. It wasn't just a blade and a trough,
mm-hmm.
right? The older guns. And so better sights, that's one of the things that I know Tom Gibbons talks about this a lot in his instructor class, that actually having sights you could see caused people to want to use them more.
Right. Yeah, it certainly helps.
That if you just had a couple of nubs and a trough to work with, that hip shooting didn't seem like such a bad idea, but if you had good sights on your pistols, well, why don't I just bring the gun up a little bit higher? There's a great interview with Jack Weaver that's out there you can find on YouTube where he talks about the decision to, well, if I just raise my gun up another foot, I could see the sights and seem like I could hit better. That apparently was a big moment. But you also see articles from Cooper and from Askins and several others where they're not just kind of hunting rifle-oriented gun riders that shoot pistols occasionally, but guys that were really pistoleros writing articles advocating, hey, you really should put two hands on your gun. It's not just for women and children. It's okay to grip the gun with two hands and bring it up to eye level. So there was a number of, in the 60s, you can find a bunch of examples, 60s and 70s for sure. You can find examples where their gun writing changed and it became, hey, let's aim our pistols.
Well, and so it seems like, too, that was an era where the gun writing was done by people that, I need to be careful how I say this, otherwise I'm going to make a lot of my colleagues very mad. No, you know what? F it. That seems to be an era where a lot of the gun writing was done by people that really knew what they were talking about. Or at least had quite a bit of practical experience in the hunting of other armed individuals. Like you mentioned Askins, who got into quite a few shootings. You know, and I remember like some of the experiments he had done with trying to figure out early night sights, you know.
Right.
Wow, Melody just gave herself a brain aneurysm trying to hold a sneeze in to not interrupt the show, and it was amazing. Oh, did you hit your head on the mic? Nice. I wish we had a camera in here. But as far as like, so that was a big deal to have like the people that had the voice, and that was also back when the internet was not a thing at all. So all of the information came pretty much from those magazines. So that was a big deal to have people like, hey, these bumpy things, maybe we should use them.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one of the biggest things that's carried forward to the present day was those leather slap matches turned into a laboratory.
Yeah.
And that laboratory became advanced into USPSA, and later things like the NTI and the Tactical Conference. And, you know, there's lots of little laboratories that have sprung up since that era. And so there's a lot of knowledge where, and it's all come from the private sector for the most part. If the military and law enforcement had been coming up with things, they're a lot more tight-lipped about sharing it. And but certainly the widest dissemination of new ideas since the 70s, for sure, has come from private sector schools that had the freedom to innovate and the not limited by, you know, bureaucratic restrictions, but also the burden of we can't just go try untested stuff in the real world because we're going to be held responsible for it legally. I think
right.
Sometimes private sector trainers are like, well, those guys in the military and law enforcement, they don't innovate. I think to a certain degree it's that they shouldn't innovate because they need to – the responsibility they bear is higher than what private sector. Private sector has that freedom to go, hey, let's go try something different. Let's grip the gun a different way. You know, let's put a different sight on the gun because we can do those things with less risk.
Well, let's hold that thought too because we've got to go to break. Right now we're talking with Carl Wren. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300-lumen Sidekick to the 500-lumen X300 Ultra or M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, Aziz Light! Ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. And now, as a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners, you can get 30% off everything at the Surefire.com web store except suppressors and batteries by entering the discount code ALLTHELUMENS, that is ALLTHELUMENS, at Surefire.com. So we're talking with Carl Wren, and you were saying right before the break that what a lot of people lose sight of is that the private sector is able to innovate equipment and also techniques a little bit more than the mil or gov or leo side, just because the potential negative ramifications from picking one that doesn't work are less than...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, competition was the first place where that really happened, because essentially the early competitors, particularly in the 80s, had literally nothing to lose and everything to gain by trying to gain, you know, let's put a compensator on the gun, let's put a red dot on the gun, let's go design a new pistol that holds more ammo, you know, let's use a plastic gun, a plastic frame gun. That was that atmosphere of particularly the early days of USPSA, when there were no divisions and it was pretty much just show up with anything and the best shooter wins, you know, a tremendous laboratory for innovation.
Right.
And some of those things in the more conservative shooters resisted, but over time, pretty much all of those things have trickled out in one way or another. I mean, I'm old enough and have been shooting USPSA long enough. I remember all the tactical guys were down on red dots, and I had a red dot on my competition gun, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And you know, now it's the tactical guys that are all embracing the red dot. And so it's just kind of humorous to me to see how everything cycles around.
It's – well, it's funny, too, and this is really tangential to what we're talking about, but the number of individuals that, like, looked at your red dot thing that you did previous and were like, Carl's anti-red dot, and it's like, no, that's not what you should get out of this at all. But anyway, I digress. So you go up to the gun sight era and we're looking at 1911s, and all of a sudden we've got sights on the gun, and you can maybe reload it a little bit quicker than you could with the double action revolvers of the 30s, especially with no speed loaders. And
yes.
where do we find ourselves next?
The next big thing is the double-action, single-action guns, and that's the military quals from the 80s and the FBI qual from the 80s and early 90s. That, you know, the FBI, that they started switching over from point shooting to Weaver. There was a period in there where they revolutionized their program, and the Weaver revolution from gun sight finally found its way into the FBI curriculum. And so that's another kind of era where in the class we shoot military handgun qual from the M9 era, and we shoot the FBI qual from the, you know, the 40 double action, single action era, post Miami shootout in particular. And right. So there's that era. And then the final stage gets into the polymer striker-fired guns, and we shoot, for example, I've got the qualification course for a local major metro PD and here in Texas, and we shoot that, and we shoot the current FBI qualification. And one of the things I found was super interesting in the beta version of the class I ran this last weekend is those courses of fire were the ones the shooters in class did extremely well on.
Right.
They emphasize fast shooting from 7 to 15 yards with reloads and strong hand only shooting and that sort of thing. It was the courses of fire were drawing quickly. If you didn't have a ability to, say, draw and fire two shots in 1.5 seconds, which is fairly quick at 7 yards, you know, that was difficult for some of the kind of medium grade shooters who could shoot okay on a drill that had more shooting where the draw time mattered less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had 4 seconds to draw and fire four rounds, they maybe were a little slow getting the gun out, but then they could hammer those rounds on the target. But then once we moved back to 25 yards, it was humbling, and I guess some of the students might even say humiliating to deal with shooting at those distances, and it's because we don't practice those things.
Right.
People go to the range and they shoot. They can shoot now. They can shoot fast targets up close. That's, you know, IPSC and IDPA. But if you're a USPSA shooter, you draw your gun 4 times in a match. If you're an IDPA shooter, you draw your gun once per stage typically.
Right.
So the draw time in those don't matter that much. So they're good at the shooting part, and maybe they don't work on their draw that much. And neither shooting sport really has a lot of shooting past 25 yards. You know, I'll put on my old guy hat and say, I remember back in the 80s when we used to shoot area championships, there would be a 50-yard standards at every, you know, major IPSC match.
Right.
And that just disappeared at some point, probably in the 90s. It just, all that stuff sort of faded out in favor of, you know, 30-round shoot and scoot, complicated choreographed things that were less look like old-time fire standards and more like, you know, modern run and gun kind of stuff. And so you see it on the competition side. We just don't practice that anymore. So when people get tested on it, it exposes those stuff. Well, we don't practice it, so we're not good at it.
Well, and that's really kind of one of the things that I am incredibly intrigued about with this class is that I have, you know, I learned to shoot on a double action revolver. I'm a big fan of 1911s. I spent a lot of time with double action, single action guns. I'm running a striker gun now. So, like, these are all things that I have played with at various points, and being able to see, like, how well or are you actually a rounded shooter strikes me as incredibly intriguing. But as far as, like, the double action, single action, especially, like, the FBI, you know, the post-Miami era, what were some of the other like, kind of, I guess, equipment changes that we see other than the trigger system? I mean,
Reloads is huge. Those early courses of fire with the revolvers, they didn't have speed loaders. And so you're doing a 20-second reload, loading loose rounds into your gun.
Yeah.
There's an FBI drill. It's draw, shoot 5 from the hip, reload, shoot 5 from the hip. The par time is 25 seconds. Well, about 20 seconds of that, 15 if you're fast, is spent reloading the gun.
Right.
So it's bang, 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 January, February, March, you know, and bang, 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 bang.
Right.
These days, 5 reload 5, that's going to be 6 seconds, right? For somebody that's fast with a modern pistol and modern magazines, it's 2 second build drill, 2 second reload, 2 second build drill. And so that's a huge change.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that we start to see, too, is really the rise of, like, the double column magazines become much more, standard once we get into the 80s and especially late 80s, early 90s. So
most of the qualification courses end up being shorter duration because they have to be capacity agnostic.
Right.
So you don't see a 20-round course of fire because, you know, some people are going to have to reload two or three times versus once. And so the most of the qualification courses stay roughly 5, 6, 8 rounds. You don't see typically more than 8 rounds without a mandatory reload.
Yeah. So as far as what are some of the differences in like the qualifications that we see with the 80s era, I guess, or the double action, single action era, like comparing like stuff from gunsight to then, or even stuff from the 40s to then, other than the closer stages and less emphasis on distance.
That's pretty much it. I mean, you see the time numbers start to speed up a little bit, but not dramatically. It's mainly that you don't have to go prone anymore. And the FBI course from the 80s still requires movement from shooting position to shooting position. And I think range safety started to eliminate some of that. You know, we were looking at running the FBI qual from the 40s, and if you do it properly, you have 5 minutes and 45 seconds to shoot at 60, 50, and 25 yards, and the agents were expected to shoot, get up, run to the next position, load, and continue shooting. And so potentially, if you ran that exactly the way they did, depending on the differences in shooter skill, you could have shooters 25 or 35 yards downrange of other shooters if you didn't split it up into separate blocks.
Right.
And so even with the FBI now in the 80s, the movement is everyone starts at the 7-yard line and moves to the 5-yard line. So it's only 2 yards of movement and the risk of people being downrange of each other. But back in the day, you know, they didn't have hearing protection and they didn't have eye protection. And some of the things that they did back then, it's like, well, I can't believe that anybody ever did that because that's horribly unsafe by modern standards.
Right.
But they did all that stuff. So that I did have to make some adjustments to modern concessions for safety in the way I run some of the older courses of fire because I just didn't like the idea of having people 25 yards downrange of other people.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. We got to go to break. Right now we're talking with Carl Wren. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. So we're talking with Carl Wren about historical handguns, this new class you're going to be teaching on the road. And we've sort of gone through the three of the four eras, double action revolvers, then 1911s, and then double action, single action guns, which brings us to, and I'll let you fill in from there.
Okay. I mean, the end of the course is really the modern striker-fired era, and really the local police department qual course is probably the best reflector of that because it dates from when they switched to Glocks. And you see, it looks pretty much like a modern, like the IDPA classifier kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It looks like modern shooting, and honestly, that's why most of the students did very well on that course. That was the one that everybody shot the best, because it looked like the stuff they were familiar with.
Yeah.
And so as we get closer to modern era, it gets into familiar territory and into everybody's comfort zone. Plus, they're shooting the gun they shoot all the time. They're shooting their carry guns. You know, making students shoot double action, single action guns from Weaver stance is all unfamiliar. Making them thumb cock double action revolvers and shoot them one-handed at 50 and 60 yards is unfamiliar. And so, you know, inevitably the scores are going to be lower.
Right.
But you know, part of the 2-day course will be there is going to be a challenge coin, and those that, you know, meet the passing standards or the expert standards for all of the courses of fire, because I grade them using the standards of the era.
Right.
And so, you know, anybody that gets through the whole 2-day course with all the 16 to 18 courses of fire that we're going to shoot and can do everything, that'll be kind of a special thing, I think, to reward those that are really well-rounded shooters that can do pretty much everything that we've done with a handgun in the last 80 years with all the action types. Certainly, that would be a challenge to aspire to for those that are really into shooting and like the diversity of it and don't want to be just specialists at one thing. And so I think that part of the class will appeal to some that like a challenge because it'll take some work.
Well, and I'm not going to say that you had me a challenge coin, but when you were announcing this and you're like, oh yeah, and you know we're going to recognize people that are able to shoot to these standards with the period correct firearms or as close to them as we can get, that's really cool to me because I think that you know. And I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but there are quite a few people that sort of like, oh, I'm good enough. And like finding new ways to push yourself and new ways to stay engaged is really important. And I think this is a really cool thing that's sort of neat, especially for the people that are history minded, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as a class that anybody that's certainly an instructor, if you're teaching other people, you need to know where all this stuff came from. You need to know the why, and you probably need to be familiar with it.
Yeah.
You know, at one time, cup and saucer was a legit technique that was taught. Now it's, you know, considered something that needs immediate correction if we see it on the range.
Yeah.
At one point, putting your thumb behind the revolver was okay. Now if you put your thumb behind the slide, it's no good. Well, okay, why do people do that? Well, it's not necessarily that they're dumb. It's that they learned from somebody who's, you know, got state-of-the-art 1960s technique.
Right.
So it's
well, and I think it's really important too when you get those students on lines that are doing those techniques, and I've seen other instructors who've just belittled them for it as though they are some, you know, stupid or something, and they don't understand that they came from a different era and there's nothing wrong with them, you know.
Yeah, it might not be like applicable to what we're doing right now, but the where it came from made sense, especially back then, I guess. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, and for those that don't have all four guns or don't want to go through the course with all four guns, it's going to be set up so that you can take the whole thing with one gun. I had three of the six students in the last weekend's class shoot one gun for the whole class.
Mm-hmm.
And for the stages that have the long revolver reloads, they had faster par times. Because obviously, if you've got a 1911 or a Glock, you don't need 20 seconds to reload your pistol. So, again, there's some adaptation. But I've got it rolled out in a half-day version, a one-day, and a two-day version. And the good news is I've got quite a bit of interest, and I've already got three commitments for road classes in Oklahoma and Arizona and Virginia. And then I'll offer it at my home range in Texas probably once or twice in 2018 in the two-day version. And I'm definitely going to present part of it at TACCON in 2018. And maybe a few other conferences people are asking about. So
nice.
In addition to my regular schedule of, you know, home-based short courses and that sort of thing, definitely looking forward to getting out on the road and bringing this class to other people and other places to let them enjoy the fun of, you know, going back to turning back the clock and really doing what they did back then and see if you can actually, you know, could you pass the Army Qual course in 1940? Could you do what all those guys did in that era? Could you do what the FBI agents had to do in the 80s?
Yeah, and I'm definitely looking forward to taking it. You know, the Virginia date is particularly interesting to me because I assume I know which range that's at, and that's a very, very nice range that is slightly closer to Texas, for me at least. So otherwise I'd be coming out to Texas to try and take it. But what – I guess we got a couple minutes left. When you started this versus like now that you've run the beta, and just in general, was there anything that you thought was going to be more of a problem than it was, or ended up being more of a problem, or that was interesting in a way that you didn't expect?
I thought the hip shooting at 7 yards was going to be harder for people than it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one skill that I budgeted extra practice time for to let people get used to the idea of doing it. But I had one of my students in the class, a guy has taken a lot of classes from me, and he's probably a good, strong, low B class shooter now in USPSA. And he was shooting everything in like a 12-inch circle in the center of the chest, his hip shooting with almost no training at all, almost from the first time. He was just smacking everything from the hip. And he's like, well, I did a lot of that stuff as a, you know, as a boy with a cap gun.
Yeah. Yep.
And so certain things come back. The one thing I'm going to change when I run it at TACCON is I'm going to spend more time letting people practice at 50 and 25 yards before I test them. Mm-hmm. That was the glaring weakness that everybody had. They just freaked out. It's like the target is so small, and what do I do? And a lot of it was running out of time. Yeah. A lot of it was we're so used to shooting in the go fast mode.
Yep.
That when I tell you have 45 seconds to fire six rounds, then you're done in 15.
Yeah.
And you should use 45 seconds. And so actually teaching people to shoot slowly and deliberately, that's something I'm going to spend more time on to help people understand how to manage their time. Because I think if I retested that group that shot this last weekend and gave them another shot at all those tests, I think their scores on the long range stuff would come up, because after they shot it, like, oh, I didn't think I had that much time.
Right. Right. Well, hey, Carl, I really appreciate you coming on the show. If people want to find out more about this or more about just the training you offer at your home range, where can they do that at?
krtraining.com and my blog, blog.krtraining.com, which I have a number of articles about the historical handgun and the books and the AARs from the class and some of the books I've been reading and other commentary there. So that's where I'm going to post all the sort of ongoing thoughts and evolution as I offer the course more and continue to refine it.
Excellent. Hey, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to come and talk to us. It's always a pleasure.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, no worries, dude. So I will talk to you later, sir, and I'm looking forward to coming out of the class. So be safe,
Wonderful.
Brother.
All right, appreciate it. Bye-bye. Yep.
Make sure you guys check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.